I have a book in my library that has an interesting title. The title of this book is The Good Old Days, They Were Terrible. I don't know whether you've seen this book, but it reminds me every time I look at the title and leaf through its pages that the good old days weren't always good. Now, I haven't lived as long as some of you, but I've lived longer than many of you. So, I don't know, somewhere in between, I can remember some past time. And this book deals with several different situations that existed 100 years ago in these United States. We have talked a little bit about the physical problems of 100 years ago in passing. We do know that hospitals 100 years ago were not places so much of healing as a place to go to die. They had no understanding of anesthetics much. They did not have any idea of cleanliness and many other things, and so surgery and other things that went on in hospitals were not very anesthetic and antiseptic, and it was a difficult time. If you lived in some of the big cities, you had to be careful as you walked down the street to step around what the horses had left. There were epidemics of various kinds that seemed to wipe out whole families. I was interested a few years ago to go to the Adventist Review and take a look at the record of those who had died in 1863. That was the year of Ellen White's major health vision. I discovered 90 obituaries in that record. And of those 90, 47 did not reach the age of 20. In that setting, I want to look with you at what I consider a pioneer in healthful living in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, Joseph Bates. Joseph Bates was born July 8, 1792, so more than 200 years ago he was born at Rochester, Massachusetts. His father was a volunteer in the Revolutionary War, and attained the position of captain. We know that later, as General Lafayette from France came to visit the United States, he, of course, had helped us in that Civil War, or in that Revolutionary War. He was on our side against the British. When he came to the home where Captain Bates lived, that is Joseph Bates' father, he recognized him and called him by name. So Bates had been a volunteer in the Revolutionary War, and even the General Lafayette remembered him from those years earlier. Young Bates lived on the coastline of Massachusetts at the city or the town of Fairhaven, just across a little inlet from New Bedford. And it was a whaling port. The ships would come and go from there, going out seeking whales. And early young Joseph became excited about traveling on the sea. He wanted to persuade his parents that he should go, but they did not want to see him leave. The life of a sailor then, as probably now, was not the best in terms of being conducive to Christianity. His father was a Christian, his mother as well. His father had helped, for example, to establish a school there in Fairhaven. It still stands as a museum now today, Fairhaven Academy. So it was a religious family, and they were concerned that young Joseph wanted to travel on the sea as a sailor. Finally, they decided that at the age of 14, perhaps they could get him to, they would allow him to take a trip to Boston by sea. His uncle agreed that he could go with him on a trip, and so they thought maybe that would get it out of his system. Well, it had just the reverse effect. He was even more convinced that he wanted to go as a sailor. And so, at the age of 14, he signed on a ship with his parents' reluctant agreement to go to Europe as a cabin boy, age 14. This was in June of 1807. This was the beginning of 21 years for Joseph Bates on the sea as first a cabin boy and then moving up in rank until finally he was captain of his own ship near the end of his experience. On his travel to far parts of the world, we find that early in his experience, while he was still in his mid-teens, the Danes were fighting with the British, and he was on a ship that struck icebergs and had to go into the port in Ireland to be refitted and repaired. And then they decided to join a British convoy of ships going to one other place, and as they joined this convoy, they were intercepted by a couple of Danish privateer boats, and Joseph Bates was taken captive by the Danes. The story tells us that these men called in the people of the ship, the sailors from the ship, and as Joseph Bates was the youngest, he was 15, 16, they decided to ask him first why he was there and what he was doing there, and they warned him that if he didn't tell the truth, there would be severe repercussions. In fact, they even told him what it would be. They said, if you don't tell the truth about the idea that you were in this British convoy, they weren't sure. He said, we have a box over here, and it's arranged so that if you don't tell the truth, we'll cut off your two first fingers and your thumb on your right hand. Well, you know, a boy of that age doesn't want to lose a part of his hand. And that was a threat. Well, he told the truth. The rest of his crew also told the truth that they had been traveling with this British convoy. And so they were not mutilated as promised. However, as they later passed a place where there were other prisoners, they discovered that the Danes had followed through with this plan, and several of them had the two fingers and thumb of their right hand cut off. Pretty rough life and pretty rough situation to face. Well, because he had been captured by the Danish privateers, he was kept in their care for some time and then finally released, and he was trying to get back to the United States, and he was then captured by the British. That was 1810. And he was American, and of course the British and the Americans weren't on very good working terms at that time, and so he was pressed into the British Navy for service for the next 2.5 years. And then the War of 1812 broke out, and he was asked to join them in fighting against his own native countrymen, Americans. And with several of the others who had been pressed into British service, he refused to serve, and so he was put in prison. He, for a part of the time, was on a prison ship near London. Eventually ended up in Dartmoor Prison and served about 2.5 years in prison after the first 2.5 years of impressed service by the British Navy. He tells of an experience when he was on the ship there near London. the prisoners decided they would attempt an escape. So they got a common table knife and made teeth on this table knife so that they could cut through the wooden beams down in the prison hold under the top deck of the prison ship. And they began working on it. 40 different prisoners taking turns with this table knife that had been sharpened like a saw. Then someone was able to get a hold of a poker from the ship, and it hastened their work, but they did work for quite some time until finally they had cut through this plank. It took them about 30 to 40 days to finally get through the plank and then to the copper of the ship side, and they eventually began working on a hole to escape. They discovered that the hole was just below the place where the guard stood every day and night, calling out occasionally, "All's well," while these prisoners down there were cutting a hole in the side of the ship. Well, they finally got a hole big enough to get a man through, and so they decided to escape. They knew that the watch on top would perhaps hear them going through, and so some of them decided to sing sailor songs loud and clear so the watchman could not hear them escaping. And so one night they began gradually escaping, one after the other. Bates was not among the first to go. In fact, he stayed on the ship. He was planning to go the second night. There were 18 of them that escaped that first night. Now, you know, there was a count of prisoners the next day, and so they had to figure out another way to report the number that were there. There were two decks in which prisoners were kept, and they cut a hole between the two. And when the British forces counted the prisoners on the one deck and went to count the other, why, 18 of them went through that hole so that the count always was the same. That was Joseph Bates as a teenager involved in such things. He tried to escape several times, never did have a chance to do so, or never accomplished it, because as those first 18 sailors went through the hole that first night, they decided the next night they were going to escape, and when they got to the hole, there were two drunken Americans at the hole, and they said, "We're going first." Well, they decided that rather than make a noise and fuss at that time, that they'd allow these two to go through. So the first one went through the hole, and so drunk he didn't know where he was hardly, and he disappeared into the water. And then the second man went through the hole. Well, he couldn't swim, and he just sank to the bottom like a rock. And when he came up, he was sputtering and hollering and shouting, and of course, you know what that did. It alerted the British that something was happening, and they were about to kill him, and he said, "No, no," he says, "I'm a prisoner." And in this way, they discovered the hole. So Bates never got away that night. The ship's carpenters were called in, and of course they had a large number of tools, and the prisoners stole some of these tools and went to the other side of the deck the next day, and with these more improved tools were able to cut a hole the other side of the deck. Unfortunately, somebody left a blanket hanging out of the hole and it was discovered, so that one was thwarted. Joseph Bates talks about being in Dartmoor Prison in 1814. He dug a hole under the double wall, and they were about to escape, and some of the prisoners informed on them, so they didn't get out of there. He finally was released from Dartmoor, April 27, 1815, 5 years to the day after he had been taken captive by the British. He'd spent 2.5 years in the British Navy and 2.5 years as a prisoner. Now, Bates was 22. He came back to the United States and, of course, began again his service as a sailor. And this is the story of some of the beginnings of this most interesting man. He married Prudence Nye in 1818, in between sailings. 6 weeks after his marriage, while he was off on another ship, Bates was a man that you couldn't hold down in one place, and off he was again. His wife, as some of you have read his story, was concerned about his salvation. Among sailors, it wasn't the best setting in which to live. Bates picked up the habit of smoking cigars and using tobacco, chewing tobacco and other things. He took up profanity. He also took up drinking, alcohol. And obviously, his life was not going the right direction. His wife was concerned about him, and so she put a New Testament into his bag when he shipped out. And one of the sailors on this particular trip died, and Bates was asked to have a service at his death. And it sobered him as to what direction his life was taking. And he decided that he would do something different. And so gradually over the next few years, he stopped the use of alcohol. He stopped smoking cigars. When he traveled home, he established family worship with his wife in between trips. He was involved with a revival, a spiritual revival at Fairhaven, and was baptized by immersion into the Christian church. Immediately after this, he began to make other plans and other directions of his life. He now, in 1827, was the captain of a ship, and so he sailed with a crew on a trip. And in this particular trip, or on this particular trip, he laid down some rather interesting rules for sailors. There was to be no swearing on the voyage, no washing or mending clothes on Sundays. Sunday was to be kept holy, no shore leave on Sunday, no liquor or intoxicating drinks on board. Liquor was only used as medicine, and it had to be dispensed by Bates. Prayer was to be a regular part of their life. They were to have religious service on Sundays. Well, now that's a strange set of rules for a bunch of hard sailors. Well, when the voyage began, some of the crew members expressed doubts about some of these rules and whether they could live by them. But when the voyage concluded, several of them requested the privilege of going with Bates on another trip. Some said it was the best they'd ever had. At least two members of the crew were converted while at sea. This was to be, however, Bates' last voyage. And when he arrived in New Bedford on June 20, 1828, it was to mark the end of his time at sea. He retired at the age of 35. Now that sounds young to us today, but if you would go back to that time, and I've mentioned it perhaps in other situations, the average age or the average lifespan at that time was about 32. So he really had lived past the average lifespan of that time. But he retired at the age of 35 with a small fortune for that time, about $11,000 that he'd saved up from his time at sea. When he settled at home in Fairhaven, he took up temperance work. He established and organized the Temperance Society. He built a meeting house. He became involved in anti-slavery work. And he continued his direction in healthful living. He gave up the use of tea and coffee in 1835. In 1839, Bates first heard the preaching of William Miller. He accepted it as truth almost immediately, and after securing a book of William Miller's lectures, he was further convinced of the truth and became a Millerite Adventist in 1839. When there was a general conference of the Millerite Adventists in Boston in 1840, Joseph Bates was one of 16 who signed the call for the conference. It was obvious that he was about to change the focus of his direction of thinking and planning from anti-temperance, anti-slavery work to presenting the second coming of Christ. Bates was to become a major leader in the Millerite movement. When Miller came to Fairhaven in 1841 for some meetings, Bates was living there, and in March of that year, he held a series of meetings in the Christian church that Bates had helped to build. By the way, if you were to go to Fairhaven today, you could still find this church. It's no longer a church. The last I knew, it was a place, a boys' club, but I've been in the building. It's very interesting. This is where Miller preached, and Bates helped to build this church. Bates decided he would let someone else take his place in the meeting because there were so many people coming, large crowds, to hear Miller. But after hearing the first one, he listened from the door. He said, "I'm going to listen to all of them," so he didn't miss any. Those who had been associated with Bates in his anti-alcohol, his temperance days, anti-slavery days, and so forth, began to complain that he talked too much about Christ's second coming. Well, he finally withdrew from the Christian church. At that time, some of his friends involved in temperance and anti-slavery causes asked why he didn't attend their meetings, and he said, "Well, I have a new focus of my life. I found enough to keep me busy in telling the world about the second coming of Christ." And so Bates had to establish a priority in his thinking and his public work. Well, he attended several Adventist camp meetings in 41 and 42 and recalls the deep interest and the large crowds that came to these meetings. The solemn spiritual atmosphere of these gatherings as thousands of people came to hear the message of Jesus' second coming. Second Advent publications were now multiplying. Newspapers carried the news of the Advent. It was an exciting and interesting time to live. And in 1843, Bates finally sold his home in Fairhaven and settled his debts and went out to share his belief full-time in the Second Advent. He traveled for several months in the South with a friend by the name of H.S. Gurney. They held Advent meetings in several towns in Maryland where slavery was still prominent. He had some interesting experiences of being threatened with death and so forth because of his work. He met some opposition because of his abolitionist background, but he assured those he met that his interest was to free all from the slavery of sin, both black and white, and his meetings attracted large and attentive audiences. Now, interestingly enough, this fortune that Joseph Bates had at the time of his retirement from the sea was used to support his work in the preaching of Miller, and by the time of the disappointment, he'd spent it all. He had nothing of that fortune left. After the disappointment, Bates accepted the Sabbath. We talked about this some, how that he went up in 1845 to Washington, New Hampshire, and met with the Sabbath-keeping pastor there, Frederick Wheeler, and with Cyrus Farnsworth and others who had accepted the Sabbath, and he discovered the Sabbath for himself and began keeping it. He also accepted, of course, the three angels' messages and the other part of Seventh-day Adventist belief. But Bates was never to get travel out of his blood. When he left the ocean, he continued to travel by land and share his Advent faith now after 1844. And as I said, he went searching for truth wherever he heard of it, including the Sabbath. Of course, you know that when he came back from that trip in Washington, New Hampshire in early 1845, a very familiar story of how he met a friend by the name of Hall on the old bridge approach to between Fairhaven and New Bedford. And Hall called out to him, "What's the news, Captain Bates?" Well, he said, "The news is that the seventh day is the Sabbath." And he shared his belief in the Sabbath. And after careful study, his friend Hall also became a Sabbath keeper. But this was not enough for Bates. He decided that he should write out what he had found out in terms of the Sabbath. And so in late 1845 and early 1846, he began to write out what he had heard and understood about the Sabbath. I imagine there were at least a few times that he was glad he told the truth, because his writing fingers and thumb he still had, and he wrote. One day as he was busy writing his tract, and again, this is a story that many of you know, but it fits the story of Bates that we're telling. His wife came into the room with a request. She said she needed some flour to finish her baking. And Bates said, how much do you need? Well, she said, "I need 4 pounds. And so, "All right," he said, "I'll get it for you." So he walked to the nearest store and purchased with his last coin a York shilling. They were still using some British money at that time, 4 pounds of flour. When he returned, York shilling, by the way, would be equivalent to about 12 and a half cents. You know, you could buy 4 pounds of flour quite reasonably then. When he returned to the house, he put the flour on the kitchen table and then returned to his writing the tract on the Sabbath. A few minutes, his wife came into the room and she said, "Where did this flour come from?" "Well," he said, "from the store. I went and bought it. Didn't you say you needed 4 pounds? And then she turned to him and she said, "Do you mean you only bought 4 pounds of flour?" "Yes," he replied. "You might as well know I spent the last money I have for that 4 pounds of flour." "Well, what are we going to live on?" she said. "Well," he said, "prudence, the Lord will provide." "That's what you always say," she said, "the Lord will provide." And weeping, she left the room. A few minutes later, Bates felt impressed. There was a letter for him at the post office. Many of you know this story. Sure enough, he went to the post office and there was a letter for him. 5 cents postage was due. You know, when you sent letters in those days, you didn't always pay the postage. You allowed the person you sent it to pay the postage. 5 cents was due. Well, Bates told the postmaster he didn't even have the money for the postage, and the postmaster assured him, "Oh, don't worry, Captain, I trust you, take the letter." "No," he said, "I don't want to take it, but I'm impressed there's money in that letter. Would you open it for me?" And so the letter was opened by the postmaster, and inside there was $10. Postage paid, Bates went back to the store to purchase groceries. He asked the delivery man to leave them at his home. And he said to the delivery man, "The woman at that house is going to object that you deliver them, but you leave them anyway." And so he ordered a barrel of flour now. Now again, $10 spent would buy a lot in those days. A barrel of flour and potatoes and other things, quite a large order of groceries. I can hardly get $10 worth of groceries in a single sack today, but you know what we're talking about. He returned to his study, didn't tell his wife about it, came in another door and sat down at the table and began to write again about the Sabbath. And again his wife came into the room very excited, and she said, "Where did all those groceries come from?" Well, Bates said, "Didn't I tell you the Lord would provide?" And then he told her about the letter and showed it to her and had her read it. Well, she went to her room and for another weeping and confession of her lack of faith. And Bates continued his work on the tract. Now, it's very interesting because about this time, H.S. Gurney, who was a very close friend of Bates and had traveled with him and worked with him, knew of his preparing of a tract upon the Sabbath, and sometime earlier, when Gurney had left his place of employment to go out and preach the Advent message, his employer had said, "Well, your leaving is causing a great deal of difficulty, so I can't pay you what I would normally owe you." It was $100. That was a lot of money in those days. Well, one day Gurney was walking down the street and his former employer met him on the street. He recognized him and he said, "Oh, Mr. Gurney," he said, "I'm so sorry that I treated you as I did." He said, "I know that I owe you $100." And right there on the street, he handed him $100. Well, Gurney thought about his friend Bates writing a tract, and Bates didn't know where the money would come for the printing of this tract, and so he was planning to go to the publisher to pick it up. Well, what happened was this. Gurney took the $100, went to the printer, and paid it, and it covered the cost of the printing of this tract. Didn't tell Bates about it at all. Well, Bates later on went to the printer, knowing when the tract was due to be paid for and picked up, and he began to apologize to the printer. He said, "Well, you know, I had hoped to pick up this tract today, but I don't have money." Well, the printer said, "That's all right. It's already been paid for." "Well, who did it?" "Well," he said, "I don't know, but a man came in here the other day and laid down $100, and there's your tract. You can take them with you." And to his death, Bates did not know who'd paid that $100. You think the Lord provided? Now, here's a copy of the little tract. And you know the connection, don't you? Because this tract was finally published in 1846, and this is when we're talking in our story about the experience. It was published in August of 1846, and it came to the attention of who? James and Ellen White at the time of their marriage. And on the basis of this tract, Ellen and James White accepted the Sabbath. You know, I mentioned before, these tracts had small pages but big titles. The Seventh-day Sabbath, a perpetual sign from the beginning to the entering into the gates of the holy city according to the commandment. That was his title. By Joseph Bates. New Bedford, Press of Benjamin Lindsay. These were great people, weren't they? Marvelous men and women who determined that they would give whatever they had to the service of the Lord. James White first met Bates when James was only 25 and Bates was 54. Now, Bates's experience as a careful person in what he ate and drank, and of course the giving up of tea and coffee and alcohol and tobacco and all of these. He also gave up other things. James White first met him and he was amazed as he met him because he knew that he'd spent 21 years out on the high seas in rough circumstances, going through storms and living as a sailor would live in those days, and James White writes about his impressions of Bates when he first met him. Remember, James White, 25, Bates, 54. He said he had at that time discarded flesh meats of all kinds, grease, butter, all kinds of spices from his own plate. When asked why he did not use them as articles of food, his usual reply was, "I've eaten my share of them." And White marveled at Bates' appearance. He said his countenance was fair. His eye was clear and mild. His figure was erect and of fine proportions, and he was the last man to be picked out of a crowd as one who had endured the hardships and exposure of sea life and who had come in contact with the physical and moral filth of such a life for more than a score of years. Bates physically showed in his appearance that he had lived a clean life. Though he had been an early writer on the Sabbath, Bates never made prominent his personal health habits as a guide for others. He only lived it. Sometimes maybe some of us might be better if we'd live it rather than push it on other people. Of course, we need to be witnesses for healthful living too. But his physical appearance and his habits became a living example of good health habits and endorsed the health message before it ever came to Ellen White. Now, Bates didn't quit traveling, as I mentioned earlier. And in 1852, at the age of 60, he decided to travel by train, not really knowing where he was going, in a way. He just decided to start out traveling. He was in Michigan. And as he traveled by train, he came into the train station at Battle Creek, Michigan, and he was impressed to get off. He didn't have any commission to go to Battle Creek. There was an impression to get off the train. Well, when he got off the train, he began looking for someone he could witness to. At the post office, he made a rather direct approach to the postmaster, and some of you know of this story too, I'm sure, and he asked this question. He wanted to know who the most honest man in town was. Well, the postmaster replied, "Well, the one I think of as most honest is a man by the name of David Hewitt. He was a traveling salesman." And the postmaster directed Bates to his home. It was early in the morning before breakfast, and he was knocking at the door of the Hewitt home. He joined the family for breakfast and even conducted worship. That was the way Bates was. He didn't hesitate to share his faith. And then after breakfast, he told them that he was a Sabbath keeper, and he introduced the Sabbath to David Hewitt and his family. And the rest of the Adventist message. This was 1852. And Hewitt and his family accepted the urging of Joseph Bates and became Seventh-day Adventists. We had no Adventists in that town at that time, and so the Hewitt home became the place for Adventists to meet. Until they had a church later. It's interesting that Bates continued to share his faith. And it's interesting to me that the beginning of the work in Battle Creek can be traced back to that visit by Joseph Bates in 1852, where he shared his faith with the most honest man in town. Aren't you thankful for Joseph Bates? What a tremendous person. Now, he was the older of the group. He was the patriarch among Adventists. In fact, when the Seventh-day Adventist Church was formally organized in 1863, he was 70 years old. But he would continue to be the patriarch of the Adventist group to the end of his days. Now, as probably you may guess, a person who had such a strict habit of living in terms of eating and drinking and so forth might somehow sometimes be under suspicion that they were taking an extreme position. Bates was not saved from that. And in fact, it had even come to the attention of Ellen White that perhaps he was not eating as he should. And so in 1872, just a year or so before he died, or just a few months really before he died, Ellen White wrote a letter to Bates and expressed some concern that she'd heard that he wasn't eating correctly, that he was just existing on bread and water. Well, we have a record of the letter she wrote back to him. It appears in an article that was prepared by James White in the Health Reformer. And this is some of what Bates wrote to Ellen White. God bless you, Sister White, for your favor of yesterday. You say I must have good, nutritious food. I learned from report that I'm starving myself and am withholding from my daughter, who is with me and alone a good part of the time, in my absence. Ellen, his wife had died. Prudence had died before him, so he was living with his daughter. And that when I ask a blessing at my table, I ask the Lord to bless that which I may eat and not that which is on the table. Well, this is what I'm not guilty of, nor ever was in all my family worship for some 50 years, but once. He said, I do greatly marvel how my industrious neighbors found out this one exception, but I'll tell you the circumstance. And then he tells Ellen White about what had happened. Several years ago, he said, I was with the church in Vassar, Tuscola County, Michigan, and was invited to address them and their children in a barn on the 4th of July and also to dine with them. The tables were soon up and loaded with tempting eatables, and I was invited to ask the blessing. The swine's flesh upon the table I knew was an abominable and unclean from creation. God had positively by law forbidden the eating or touching of it. I therefore very quietly distinguished and asked a blessing on the clean, nutritious, wholesome, and lawful food only. Some whispered and some smiled and others looked on, and that was the basis of the story. Then he goes on. He says, starving with more than enough to eat. Now allow me to state what by the providence and blessing of God we have in our house. Well, he proceeds to tell Ellen White what he has as food in the house. It's not just bread and water. He said, we have 90 pounds of white flour. We have 100 pounds of gram flour, 5 bushels of choice garden corn, sweet corn in abundance, cornmeal, rice and oatmeal, corn starch, butter, sugar, salt, 3 varieties of potatoes, sweet turnips, parsnips, squashes, 2 varieties of onions. He's giving her a list of what his cupboard has. 11 cans of sweet peaches, 6 cans sweet grapes, strawberries preserved and dried, quince and grape jelly, tomatoes by the jug, 20 pounds of dried sweet peaches, a box of Isabella grapes, mostly consumed, 3 varieties of apples and quinces. He says, at our door, as good a well of water as there is in the state of Michigan, large cistern of rainwater, an iron pump, a 40-gallon filter, lamp oil, candles, abundant clothing, cooking stove, and 8 cords of dry wood under cover, more at the door if I want it, and the most convenient and well-finished dwelling house in the place. He was just giving her a list of where he was living and what he had. He went on in his letter to tell about his experience. Allow me to say that when I had gained the victory over the deadening, besotting, benumbing vice of alcohol and tobacco, I was free. I could appreciate God's handiwork in sea and sky, even in the tumbling, rolling waves. I could breathe freely, inhaling the pure air of heaven, and shout, I was a free man. Therefore, if any demand is ever made on me for tobacco, tea, coffee, or strong drink of any kind that intoxicates, they must present me an order from the court above. That was Joseph Bates. I love him. A very, very special person in the beginnings of this church's history. A man who, along with James and Ellen White, was a co-founder of this church and was faithful to his belief till his dying day. And so the story today has reminded us that the Lord can use sea captains and Gurney, a blacksmith, to help make possible the preaching of the message. He can use us today too, can't he? And as we commit ourselves and our lives to the Lord's care and keeping, we can be assured that He will bless others through us. I thank the Lord again today for such men and women as Captain Bates.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.